Thus, the Starbucks guy's mantra, "I can choose for myself," raises the next and indispensable question, what are you going to choose? It is not enough to answer whatever my inner self dictates. Even the inner self needs a compass. It operates according to some substantive understanding of the good life. There is no cause to believe that this understanding is impervious to reason and cannot be shaped through education and discussion. The grave weakness of the ethic of authenticity is that it evades this fundamental issue and simply stresses the autonomy of choice. Since the earliest days of Athens and Jerusalem, most of the great figures of Western civilization have regarded the question of the content of the good life as the central one. The American founders agreed with this, and they created a mechanism that allows people to pursue the good life without government interference. Since the triumph of authenticity in the 60s and 70s, the emphasis has been on radical freedom, largely to the exclusion of the question of what that freedom is for. The great conservative challenge is to bring this issue back to the forefront. Our freedom and autonomy are precious commodities, and conservatives better than anyone else recognize that it is a great tragedy when they are trivialized and abused. Their mission, therefore, is to steer the American ethic of authenticity to its highest manifestation, and to ennoble freedom by showing it the path to virtue. Chapter 6. America the Beautiful. What we are fighting for. We have it in our power to begin the world all over again. Thomas Paine. America represents a new way of being human and thus presents a radical challenge to the world. On the one hand, Americans have throughout their history held that they are special, that their country has been blessed by God, that the American system is unique, that Americans are not like people everywhere else. This set of beliefs is called American exceptionalism. At the same time, Americans have also traditionally insisted that they provide a model for the world, that theirs is a formula that others can follow, and that there is no better life available elsewhere. Paradoxically enough, American exceptionalism leads to American universalism. Both American exceptionalism and American universalism have come under fierce attack from the enemies of America, both at home and abroad. The critics of America deny that there is anything unique about America, and they ridicule the notion that the American model is one that others should seek to follow. Indeed, by chronicling the past and present crimes of America, they hope to extract apologies and financial reparations out of Americans. Some even seek to justify murderous attacks against America on the grounds that what America does and what she stands for invites such attacks. These critics are aiming their assault on America's greatest weakness, her lack of moral self-confidence. Americans cannot effectively fight a war without believing that it is a just war. That's why America has only lost once, in Vietnam, and that was because most Americans did not know what they were fighting for. The enemies of America understand this vulnerability. At the deepest level, their assault is moral. They seek to destroy America's belief in herself, knowing that if this happens, America is finished. By the same token, when Americans rally behind a good cause, as in World War II, they are invincible. The outcome of America's engagements abroad is usually determined by a single factor, America's will to prevail. In order to win, Americans need to believe that they are on the side of the angels. The good news is that they usually are. America's enemies are likely to respond to these assertions with sputtering outrage. Their view is that America's influence has been and continues to be deeply destructive and wicked. As we have seen, this criticism comes from different directions, from multiculturalists who allege historical racism and the ongoing oppression of minorities, from third world intellectuals who deplore the legacy of colonialism, from Western leftists who see America as a force for evil in the world, and from Islamic fundamentalists and cultural conservatives who view America as culturally decadent and morally degenerate. These attacks on America usually begin with complaints about America's foreign policy. Many European, Islamic, and Third World critics, as well as many American leftists, make the point that the United States uses the comforting language of morality while operating according to the ruthless norms of power politics. This is a theme that we in America hear endlessly from leftist intellectuals like Edward Said, Noam Chomsky, and Michael Lerner. It is also a theme that Muslim fundamentalists have stressed. To these critics, America is guilty of such foreign policy outrages as overthrowing democratically elected regimes in Iran and Chile, propping up dictatorships in Latin America and now in the Middle East, fighting to protect oil fields in the Gulf War while pretending to be fighting for the rights of Kuwaitis, ignoring massive human rights violations where no American interests are involved, starving hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children through a cruel policy of economic sanctions, and demonizing people like Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, whom the United States itself once supported. These are serious charges, and they seek to expose as wide a chasm between American ideals and American actions as there was between the rhetoric of Pericles' funeral oration and Athens' rhetoric of the citizens of the island of Melos. While Pericles sang lofty hymns to freedom, the Athenian ambassadors conveyed a different message in the Melian dialogue. "If you do not submit to slavery," they told the Melians, "we will destroy you. And our reason for doing so is because we can, because the law of nature dictates that the strong do what they have the power to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept." In short, the Athenian ambassadors made explicit the law of realpolitik, that nations act based not on ideals, but on their interests, and that in the field of international affairs, might inevitably makes right. In his book, White House Years, Henry Kissinger says essentially the same thing about American foreign policy. America has no permanent friends or enemies, only interests. And in a sense, this is true. The American people have empowered their government to act on their behalf against adversaries. They have not asked their government to be neutral between their interests and, say, the interests of the Ethiopians. It is unreasonable to ask a nation to ignore its interests, because that is tantamount to asking a nation to ignore the welfare of its people. Everywhere in the world, this is taken for granted. Asked recently why he once supported the Taliban regime and then joined the American effort to oust it, General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan coolly replied, "Because our national interest has changed." When he said this, nobody thought to ask any further questions. Critics of the United States foreign policy judge it by a standard that they apply to no one else. They denounce America for promoting its self-interest while expecting other countries to protect their self-interest. Americans do not need to apologize for the fact that their country acts abroad in a way that is good for them. Why should it act in any other way? Indeed, Americans can feel immensely proud about how often their country has served them well while simultaneously promoting noble ideals and the welfare of others. So yes, America did fight the Gulf War in part to protect its access to oil, but it also fought to liberate Kuwait from Iraqi invasion. American interests did not taint American ideals. Indeed, the opposite is true. The ideals dignified the interests. But what about U.S. backing for Latin American, Asian, and Middle Eastern dictators such as Somoza in Nicaragua, Marcos in the Philippines, Pinochet in Chile, and the Shah of Iran? It should be noted that in each of these cases, the United States eventually turned against the dictatorial regime and actively aided in its ouster. In Chile and the Philippines, the results were favorable. The Pinochet and Marcos regimes were replaced by democratic governments that have so far endured.